time is an image of eternity, but it is also a substitute for eternity. The miser whose treasure has been taken from him. It is some of the frozen past which he has lost. Past and future, man's only riches. The future is a filler. The future of void filler places. Of void places. Sometimes the past also plays a sometimes part. The past also used to be a spark. I once did this or that. I used to be but. There once are this other cases when affliction but makes the thought other of happiness intolerable. When affliction makes them in robs happy sufferer intolerable has passed. Then his own robs and sufferable from above his past. As only the past does your and the future dwell, hinder the wholesome effect of affliction by providing the future loaded field, hinder for the imagination and affection of affliction that is providing. Now, the intention of past imaginary future is the first of all that renunciations. The renunciation of past and future is the first of all the present renunciations. Attain finality. Finality. Nor does the future. Does the future. For it is only present. Only what does achieve present. Present. Finality. We do not know this. We do not know this. Because the future. No. If we apply it is the present. Only to the present of that desire as of that desire of in which course we do not know finality however finality it pierces if it pierces right to the eternal to the eternal of that desire happiness is the use of despair is the use of despair. Attention, which draws the attention from the away future. From the future, eternal. That is the use of disappointment. Our pleasure, our attention, which we have been expecting from, and which we have been expecting. The disappointment is because the disappointment we are expecting is the future for expire. Disappointment the future as soon as your hands and is as soon as it is present, which is present. We will be the future, we will be there because. Without refusing, expect to be future, refusing to be future, Yes, is an absurdity.
Is it is this
of which
is an absurdity
is
around
of which
is
eternity.
I want
the future
appear
to be there.
Without
ceasing
and
the future
to come
thus
the cave
is an absurdity
to be
detached
the cave
of which
eternity
to cease
the one
to become
our future
of the
our
objective
to be
detached
means
to cease
to
make
our future
of
purification
our
objective
to
only
to find
the cave
not
only
a secret
a
method
as far
as pure
creation
are
concerned
means
to pray
that
God
to make
before
the future
not
only
a
secret
channel
as
far
as
men
are
concerned
finding
a
method
before
the
pure
creation
that God
does
not give
to
exist
not
only
the
secret
God
does
not
as men
in fact
exist
is
in the
same
way
caused
as
created
things
does
not
which
forms
to
the
only
entirely
of
experience
and
to
enhance
our
natural
faculties
everything
enter
forward
hence
forward
therefore
follows
this
one
act
not
with
supernatural
therefore
without
this
it is
suffers
that
calls
an exciting
imagination
of a
mixed
point
is
due
to
this
being
credible
with
regard
to
the
very
thousand
to
do
everything
and
also
to does
not
exist
all
is it
not
without an
object
and
suffering
caused
without
by
the
reward
of
others
he
is
due
to this
pain
the
mental
deprivation
makes
good
the
point
of
loss
for
the
loss
of
equilibrium
efforts
henceforth
is
one
very
much
multiplies
and
therefore
learn
is
and
to die
as
to our
own
death
that
is
why
is it not
the same
the imagination
but
that
could
destroy
the object
and
makes
it more
in
the future
not
the dead
bearing
deprivation
of
futures
and
the one
to point
loss
of
cause
equilibrium
is
it
sense
the same
to
me
not
to be
born
beyond
the soul
to
philosophize
is
to
contemplate
this
picture
that
something
is deprivation
of
the future
is
the
weak
and
is snatched
away
loss
to
equilibrium
into
eternity.
That
is
why
to
philosophize
is
to learn
to die
pain
and
weariness.
That
which
is
why
not
to
crossing
is
sense
of
perpetuity
to
be born
in
the soul
and
contemplating
this
perpetuity
with
acceptance
and love
when
pain,
greed,
and
weariness
are
snatched
away
to
point
into
causing
eternal
sense
of
perpetuity
to
be born
in
the soul.
Through
contemplating
this
perpetuity
acceptance and love. We are snatched away into eternity.
I think Michael told me about this piece. Are you rubbing shells together in this piece?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, he was praising it to me in my lesson.
Oh, shoot. That's awesome. I didn't know he did that. Yeah, no, that's like the thing I've been working on, like in my lessons with him this semester, especially like it's an album I did of like basically music for abalone shells, considering kind of time theory. So this kind of like, all the text that I use for the renunciation of time is by Simone Weil, who was someone who was a brilliant thinker from like the 20th century, earlier 20th century. She was a Jewish anarchist who then became Catholic later in life. You know, she fought in the Durruti Column in the Spanish Civil War against the Francoists. She did all these amazing things. She died because she wanted to experience the life of a worker in their and how they ate and how they lived. And that's literally how she died. I shouldn't be laughing at that.
Did she get sick or?
She just couldn't handle, yeah, no, she was eating like under the same, if I remember correctly, I might be messing this up, but she was eating like under the same diet and under the same diet, like under the same conditions on purpose as a worker in order to understand their plight, because she was from a very kind of middle-class romantic family.
Yeah.
Or like European family. And she did all the, she also worked in factories. She did everything she could to understand the plight of workers, which was but that was also unfortunately her ending. But she was still like a deeply like unique thinker because of just her commitment to all these things. And Renunciation of Time is from her most well-known collection. The text is Gravity and Grace, which was a collection of like aphorisms that she had written that was like put together by a farmer, I believe, who found her work. And so it's kind of just like Renunciation of Time itself is just like a collection of her thoughts on time, essentially, and on trying to move towards eternity. And so and at the same time, shells are objects of life and they're objects of time because, you know, an animal builds up its shell in order to be protected. And then when the animal dies, the shell is still there. And so then you just have the shell, which represents, you know, this life that was once lived and now is gone. And then also all the time it took in order to build this life in this home for the animal.
So you mentioned the instrumentation, it was shells and voice.
For that movement, it's just three voices and three shells. That's it.
What kind of actions are you doing with the shells in this piece? How do you play the shells?
I basically wrote it with the idea that it would be performed by three people. And so there's three voices and each person's theoretically playing a shell. In the recording, I play all parts myself. But when one part, for example, is just like rubbing the back of two shells against each other. I wish I had my shells with me, but unfortunately, my location right now, I don't. But like, it was very much like, yeah, two shells, basically the opposite of which were rubbing against each other and kind of slapping against each other. The second part, I believe, was like the inside of one shell rubbing against the outside of another. Like, and so that means because if it's an abalone shell, that means that you're rubbing the inlay against like the calcium carbonate outside, which is much more roughly textured. And so that has a different sound. And then finally rubbing the inside against the other inside, which is not really possible. Because of the shape of the shell, of course, like you can't really fit one. Yeah. It's like cupping.
That won't carry over to the radio, but
yeah.
Cupping my hands and showing how it is impossible to get inside.
Yeah.
With both insides.
Yeah. If you try and cup your hands, then you loosely have the idea of what you're getting at. but like, and then like trying to get like, that's the closest you can get to like kind of getting the inlay to like rub against itself. And so those are like the three different like sounds, basically.
So how did you choose these sounds or what did you like about them?
It's very much like the sounds for me are kind of I don't know. They're just like the first three sounds I realized when I was like playing with these shells.
Mm-hmm.
Like realizing, okay, there are three, like trying to basically come up with a differential or like three different sounds essentially, which are semi, there's some range to them, but there's also a consistency because of the movement. Like if I have these two shells against each other, rubbing against the back of each other, like I know there's going to be a sound that is connected to that motion. It's going to be a sound with some range, minimal range, and like minimal like rhythmic change, but there will be some sort of consistent timbre to that. Likewise, inside of shell, it's going to be a different sound because it's two different materials rubbing against each other. So it's really all about the interplay of like the two substances of an abalone shell, which is what I used for it. The inlay, which is like, you know, the mother of pearl-esque stuff, and then the calcium carbonate outside, which is much rougher and like textured in an interesting way. And it almost sounds like, you know, chalk being used on like a sidewalk sometimes, or like you can use on a chalkboard.
So I'm here with Jeremy Rosenstock, a composer of really cool music out of San Francisco. He's currently studying at CalArts. Is there anything you'd like to add to your general biography or description of your work?
I don't know. Mostly I just think about like duration and time. That's mostly what I'm considering. And just like sound as an energy, maybe.
Sound as an energy. What does that phrase mean?
Sound is just essentially the byproduct of movement and change over time. It's not actually it's not an object. It's something that can be created by objects, but it is just like, it's the transition of energies often from one medium to another.
And how does this concept of sound as an energy rather than as an object, how does that play out in your compositional practice?
I mean, honestly, it might just sound the same to other people. To me, it feels more just like, it's more about thinking of sound as a thing that is not a material, in contrast to something like, say, a visual artist maybe who considers sculpture or like considers the material of the stone. Like I consider my material to be almost in a way immaterial, because in that way I am thinking about like something which is inherently transient and something which is in constant change, and therefore kind of I'm only here to like moderate and curate the change to a degree, to various degrees.
Really cool. You said that earlier in our conversation that you studied piano in your undergraduate. How long have you been writing music and composing? Did you start then or earlier?
I tried to write most of my childhood, but I never really did it well because I never really like committed to it until about like maybe end of high school. Because a lot of the time it just felt like, especially when I was younger, it just felt like, there's no reason for me to write this. Like it felt a lot like I was just kind of just ripping off other things. And then around like senior year of high school, that's when I figured out, oh, here's something which feels like myself, which was like writing at the piano and then like just leaving the pedal down the whole time. It was a lot of music where just like I would hold the pedal down and then just like hold it down for the whole piece and then just let kind of the spectra build up almost. It was to a certain degree the sound of the practice room, because the practice room is where, you know, sound is coming at you from all sides. It's smaller, so you feel that sound a lot more. And so you're in this like space where you can really understand resonance.
Were you in the practice room a fair amount in high school?
Yeah, I went to a performing arts high school. It was interesting. It was not necessarily the best place for me at that time, maybe, because I was kind of a very introverted pianist, and I wasn't really ready for being in this art school in San Francisco, which was like the most liberal and out there school in San Francisco, which is saying a lot, I should say, hopefully.
No, I'm familiar with the area.
Yeah, but it was very much like, I remember the first day, because I had come from like a suburban, you know, past, like the first couple days or something, like it was always like, oh, wow, that guy has a mohawk. That guy has piercings. Like, oh, shoot, this is insane. Of course, by the end of the week, it was just like, oh, yeah, whatever. But it was a total culture shock. And so that kind of like made it weird to like kind of do work there, because I was also in the most like, the piano department was a very conservative department, as it is in a lot of cases, because piano is a medium who thinks its canon is completed and that there's not much left to be contributed to. They especially don't want new music a lot of the time. It makes sense, because like, why would you need more repertoire when you have, you know, 32 Beethoven sonatas, a bunch of Chopin, a bunch of Rachmaninoff, a bunch of Brahms, a bunch of Schumann, all of the well-tempered clavier. Like, there's so much repertoire. So in a way, like, I mean, I don't like that it's very anti-new music in some cases, but it's understandable, you know?
So let's talk about your most recent release involving piano. This is on your Bandcamp. It's Cairns Book 4. Do you want to tell me about maybe the whole series of pieces, Cairns, and particularly Book 4?
I think the first piece, the Cairns are the first pieces I wrote, which I still feel comfortable like saying that I composed as I guess, semi-amateur composer. The form of it essentially is like me compounding like well-tempered clavier and Catalogue d'Oiseaux by Messiaen. So each Cairn has two movements. The first movement of each is in ninths purely, and only in pedal, and only with the pedal down held the entire time. So basically then you're creating all these weird beat frequencies as a result of that, because of just like hearing the lack of an octave and the roughness that comes along with that as it carries and sustains and interacts with other non-octaves. The second movement every time is just kind of me giving myself freedom to do whatever I want. Yeah, the Catalogue d'Oiseaux thing here is just like, I collect these into like books of like three or two usually. Like Cairn 4 is only one Cairn, but that's just because it was especially long. Like that was me trying to engage more with what I was learning at CalArts regarding like just intonation and slowness and quietness and thinking about sound, I guess, much more rather than thinking about like notes.
So it's kind of unusual that the first is always the same, has the same feature of the ninths. Why do you do that?
I like setting strict rules for myself when I compose. It helps a lot in certain cases, especially helped when I was younger, like when I was more starting off, because like it meant then I had like some sort of like box in which to work. And like I had a space of like aesthetic space maybe, or a resonant space in which to contain my thoughts. So the ninths especially is because like they're so close to an octave, but they're not. So you end up with this thing where if you play a ninth at the piano sometimes, you'll hear the treble first, and then you'll hear the bottom sound next. And so then you're basically having this quick change almost if you listen between like say the attack and the sustain.
With these first movements, do you try to achieve a different character or sort of different feeling or different concept using the ninths, or are they all sort of supposed to be the same concept? And are they different pieces in your mind? Or are they part of the same piece of music?
The Cairns, as each book of Cairns feels like maybe it's somewhere between a collection of pieces and a piece as a whole, like each collection. The ninths themselves, like I try and change up how I use them. Like on the first Cairn I ever wrote, that was all basically like kind of high register, one octave apart ninths. And then I think around by Cairn 3, that's when I started like realizing, oh, I could also have like ninths of different, I could have octave displacement and change the location of the octaves. But also I can be in the low register too. How does that work? You know, like, how do we perceive a ninth when the ninth is separated by like five octaves or something like that? Cairn 8 is like probably the one on the album is the first one I've done in a while where it was like all major ninths. And all major ninths that are the same octave displacement apart too.
Yeah, there's a bit of the score on your Bandcamp, and it says a study in absolute consonances, which I think this is a little bit witty because most people consider a ninth to be a dissonance. But when you have it displaced this much, it is very consonant.
That's, yeah, so that's something I actually learned about from my old professor, Wolfgang, who's a JI guy at CalArts. And he was, when I was writing this, he told me about this concept of Hermann von Helmholtz, who is a great acoustician, of course, who wrote this, who called like any interval which falls in line with the overtone series, like an absolute consonance. And there aren't that many of those on the keyboard. Weirdly, like the minor third is actually one, basically, because that's a 1916. And the major ninth is pretty close to one because that's like 4 cents off altogether, maybe. Perfect fifth is pretty close to one. Octave, of course, is like probably the purest one. And so that's why it's like an absolute consonance, because we're thinking of consonants as in relation to the overtone spectrum rather than Bach keyboard counterpoint.
Well, very cool. And it, you know, even though the material is so limited, I think it's really interesting to listen to. And I really do feel like you're listening to each sonority as it happens and making sure that the piece has its own life and you're not just letting it die out. Worth a listen. Another piece on your Bandcamp that I thought was interesting. Yes, I believe it's two ice recordings. Ice Transducing and Ice Melting. Can you tell me a little bit about this album and these pieces?
Yeah, this came out of an independent study I did with Tim Feeney. He does a lot of stuff with exciters and things like that. And so what I started thinking about was how I could use sound or use like ice as a source of sound. And so for this piece, what I did was I basically kind of figured out the resonant frequency of a piece of ice or a room, and then would put that using the transducer into the block of ice.
So you played it with the transducer into the ice.
Yeah. And so then I also at the same time played through it like a sound of a recording too. I had recorded, the second track on that is actually the sound of a recorded ice or a sound of ice melting. And of course I actually do that because ice melts rather slowly in most cases. I had to have like hot tea, like hot water poured over the ice over and over again in order to keep it melting. So you really hear the action. And so that's how you get that sound of like kind of like almost like ice, like breaking apart and at a semi-consistent speed. Yeah. So then I put that into the transducer with like the sine wave that would resonate with the ice and then cause that ice to like kind of make weird sounds.
This is going to be a kind of impossible question, but when you listen to this piece, how do you get enjoyment out of listening to these sounds? Like, what is interesting or special about the sound of melting ice for you? And like, why do you want to listen to this, and why do you want to share it and have other people listen to it?
So that's a hard question.
Yeah, it doesn't be impossible, but
yeah, let's
go. If you can't answer, that's okay. I'll just edit this part out.
No, I'm going to try. This is, I'm fighting for this one. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. So like sound of, I mean, I think to a certain degree, it's like just hearing, you know, the texture of the ice, like, especially for something like that, like you know, you get to hear like almost, you can hear really closely the sound of like the ice breaking in a way, or the ice interacting with the water and the water bubbling because of the transduction or the transducing of the actual exciter against the ice. And so then you get like kind of this interesting blend of like the sine wave, what the sine wave actually does, and then also the pre-recorded sounds as well. And so you're just getting this layering of understanding of how water and ice act as a sonic source, as both a collection of sounds and as an object in which to force sounds into. It's about the collection of just like how we think about sounds and how they accumulate and how these processes, I guess, interact as a composer or whatever that means, you know. It's like you spend so much time in this small box, like creating sounds by yourself, and then you bring it out into the world, and then you're just so surprised sometimes by like what people pick up on, whereas what you're concerned about or what you're scared about in a sound is something that no one else notices, or or people think the opposite about, you know. Thank you.
I usually like to ask people about the oldest thing that I can find. I didn't look super hard, but the oldest piece, our collection of pieces I found of yours is on your Bandcamp, Beneath the Tides.
Beneath the Tides, I made freshman year of my undergrad. I was kind of in a weird space then because I didn't really know many people. And so I kind of just like, I went headfirst into like working with this four-track synthesizer I had. So that's kind of just like, it ended up being a collection of various like sounds or collection of pieces I figured out. And a lot of them are just like me realizing that I can use a sequencer and then change it, change the sound by like, you know, change the filtering or change the distortion on the synthesizer. And in doing so, then like transform the actual like sequence. You know, probably counts. It probably predicts something about like my own consideration of like, you know, how sound changes and is like a transient thing. The other thing on there though, which I think probably I like more, is like I figured out how to sample the radio from my synthesizer. And so then I found a Christian radio station because I was going to school out in Nashville and there were a lot of Christian radio stations around there. And so I just sampled that and then just played with that sound a lot. I enjoyed that personally just because then you can just like, oh, now this guy's voice is deeper. Now it's higher. It's a very juvenile thing, but it's also very fun, you know?
No, I love, you know, speeding up and slowing down recordings. It's such a simple operation, but it changes the meaning of the recording very quickly and significantly, musically and otherwise. What are some of your favorite tracks off of Beneath the Tides now?
I have to say probably like the Christian radio sample stuff.
So which ones are those then?
The third one was me, I think, trying the Bible's Trustworthy Revisited is me trying to move towards like maybe something a little larger than just like playing with sequencers or playing with samplers. And then unfortunately because I didn't really know how to mix anything or do anything like that. It's not a great piece. Like I think I would, if I had the GarageBand track still, I might try and refix it, but I don't. And that's basically me trying to figure out how to like create something a little bigger than just like a single process.
Mm-hmm.
And to a certain degree, this is like the last thing I really, pretty soon after this album, like I stopped really working with the synthesizer because I realized there are only so many sounds I can make. And I started learning Max MSP instead. And that's kind of where I do most of my electronic work now.
What is the program for this? So what does Beneath the Tides refer to? Because I guess you have like different themes to these tracks. You sort of have the Christian theme tracks and then you have these oceanic tracks.
Yeah.
And then a couple others that I'm not sure where they fit.
A lot of the first one is like just me playing with beat. The first track I should say is like kind of different also because it's like me just playing with like beat frequencies between like these sounds and like changing the timbres too. So it's a little bit of like what the sequence tracks were doing. And yeah, the Beneath the Tides though, I think is more just like me thinking about like getting to a sound where like, you know, everything's a bit murky, everything's distorted, everything's underwater almost, like thinking about like sound as something which is more abstract.
Mm-hmm. Sort of obscured, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, I should say the other one, this is the other one which I probably have listened to the most now that I look back is The Tide is High. That is a cover of the song by Blondie and the Paragons.
Nice.
And it is my version of it on like in a really like noise rock instrumental form, basically, but electronic. It's vaguely novelty, but I kind of enjoy it just because it's so dumb. Like dumb in the fun way, though, like in a good way.
No, I love a good cover. The first track is called The People United Shall Be Pacified. Is this a response or reference to something?
I was listening a lot to The People United Shall Never Be Defeated then.
The
Chevsky piece and the folk song, you know, the great Chilean folk song that, of course, became the song of Allende and the anti-Pinochet song when Allende was killed, unfortunately, or basically overthrown and destroyed by the CIA and various other groups. You can cut that out if that's too whatever off topic.
No, but, I'd love to talk about politics and put it on the show if you feel comfortable doing that.
All right, cool. A lot of these titles are just like me creating really dumb puns and such on like absurd kind of absurdist puns or whatever on like politics. Like I wrote a piece in high school and I originally called it Fanfare for the Common Tech Worker because I realized it was the dumbest title I could think of.
I mean, it's a great title, but it is horrific.
I know. That's part of it. I think a lot of these titles, like People in HLB Pacified, is the most horrific thing you can imagine. Especially because like that fit, like as a person who is like of a socialist point of view, of course that's horrifying. And like I also had another one which I named like Petty Bourgeois Solidarity March, which was of course just like another like ridiculous title because that's antithetical to everything Marx believed about the petite bourgeois. So in high school, they were the most like liberal you could be. And by liberal, I don't mean like socialist. I mean like very much Clinton / Barack Obama liberal. Like my AP civics or whatever teacher had us watch The West Wing for class. If that tells you anything about what they believed in, which is not
it does. Liberals love that show.
Yeah. And of course, there'd just be little comments like, you know, people just saying capitalism or just saying, lightly referencing maybe that capitalism isn't the best system and never really getting beyond that. Like, and so eventually I started kind of after Hillary's election, like I should say in 2016, I liked Bernie Sanders, but because of like my brainwashing, like that's ironic, but you know, a little bit of the West Wing brain I got maybe from like watching from like my AP civics class, I thought, you know, Bernie, if he gets in office, he won't be able to do anything. Like it was that type of thing. And he probably would actually have he would probably have a hard time getting his policies enacted if he were president, to be honest.
It's a very different society that elects Bernie Sanders the president.
So. Yeah. True.
It's hard probably to say. A Democrat majority in the Senate if he gets elected. I would say. So
yeah.
Who knows?
But yeah, that's like after like Hillary loses, like I think that's when I start learning a little bit more about socialism and such and realizing, oh, so liberalism isn't the only thing out there. Like I think because especially as a young person, I had this very hegemonic point of view maybe, or this view that the liberal hegemony wanted me to have, which is that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are the most liberal you can get out. Like they're the farthest you can go out and they're the most liberal you can go out and anything else is not liberal. And when I started actually thinking about like around probably a little after Bernie Sanders, like a lot of people probably my age, like we realized, oh, there's other things out there. We don't have to, there's an alternative to just like living in this depressing scenario where like Hillary Clinton and her ilk and Barack Obama and his ilk just keep winning elections and they're just like a political dynasty of liberals and that's the end of history.
Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate you coming on, Jeremy.
Of course. Thanks for listening to my stuff and like, just putting in the, just like interviewing me and everything.